The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. Good evening. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Yaron Simon. I'm the Consul General of Israel to the Mid-Atlantic region, based right out of here in Philadelphia, and it's my distinct pleasure and honor to introduce our guest speaker tonight, Knesset member Michael Oren. I had the distinct pleasure of working with Michael in his capacity as Israel's ambassador to the United States during most of my first year here as Consul General of Israel in Philadelphia. And I've come to appreciate in Michael three salient qualities that he possesses and that everyone who interacts with him comes to appreciate right away: his love of Israel, his admiration of the United States, and his passion for strengthening the ties between Israel and the United States. Couple those traits with the impressive skill set Michael has, his vast knowledge of both countries, his professional background, and his down-to-earth approach and amicable personality, and you will understand right away why I and many of my colleagues felt very fortunate to have had the opportunity to work on the same team with Michael, cultivating the relationship between Israel and its number one friend and ally in the entire world, the United States of America. An important element in cultivating that relationship entails furthering the understanding of one another on many levels. In that vein, we here at the consulate constantly strive to present a broad menu of Israel, showcasing its pluralistic society and its rich cultural diversity. On any given subject, we strive to incorporate as many perspectives as possible into the discussion. After all, Israel is arguably not one of the strongest, but I would argue the strongest democracy on the face of this earth, in large part due to the vibrant public debate that takes place on virtually any issue. While we may or may not agree with or endorse a particular point of view, we do not shy away from bringing it to the table. The State of Israel is fortunate to have had Michael Oren serve in what is arguably the most important of ambassadorial positions, and it is fortunate to have Michael serve as a parliamentarian in the Israeli Knesset today. I am certain that as an MK, Michael's work will continue to be guided by his love of Israel, his passion and love of the United States, and his passion for strengthening the special relations between those two countries. I unfortunately did not have the opportunity to bring Michael Oren to Philadelphia as Israel's ambassador, but I'm therefore doubly delighted to have had the opportunity to introduce a Knesset member, Michael Oren, to all of you this evening. So please welcome to the stage Michael Oren, my friend, my colleague, and the interviewer of this evening, President of the Middle East Forum, Daniel Pipes. Please.
Thank you so much for that warm welcome. Delighted to be here with Michael Oren. And I'll admit that when I began reading his book, Ally, a very well-written account of his 4 years plus as Israeli ambassador to the United States, I started at the beginning, as one does with books, with no idea of the news bombshells that lay ahead. The first inkling came to me when I read a column by John Podhoretz, who suggested that in the entire annals of diplomatic history had never witnessed anything quite like this astonishing account that makes news on almost every page. Well, the next few days saw a remarkable furor over the book and its related three articles that Ambassador Oren wrote. Borderline hysteria is how one Israeli journalist, Ben Caspit, summarized the Obama administration's response. Because of the enormous attention that the book has attracted, I will make the assumption that you, the audience, know something about the contents of this book, and I will focus on some of the specific issues. I have many questions for Ambassador Oren, and he has kindly agreed to be brief. He said it's difficult, but he'll be brief in his replies. Not a one-word reply, but a brief reply.
I warn you.
So that we can cover the maximum ground in the 35 minutes we have, to be followed by the 20 minutes of questions from the audience. And I have three basic topics. The first is U.S.-Israel relations. The second is the response to the book. And the third is the character and nature of our president. So, to begin with...
I can see this. You don't want to ask me about my childhood?
To begin with, U.S.-Israel relations. Now, you portray two historic principles as governing U.S.-Israel relations. No daylight, no surprises. You argue that these have been broken since 2009, and you hope they'll be quickly reasserted. But do you really see this as a possibility in the year and a half left of the Obama administration, or is this something you hope for after it leaves office?
Okay, good question. First of all, shalom, Philadelphia. Shalom and toda Yaron, our distinguished consul general and my buddy. Another buddy is my wife, Sally, and my niece, Maya, and
shalom.
Okay, Daniel, thank you. Thank you for hosting me this evening. I said that there have been two principles, certainly since the middle Reagan years. And the U.S.'s relationship is not static. It has evolved over the years. We fought the 67 war with French bullets, not with American bullets. There was no strategic alliance. Beginning in the 1980s, these two principles began to coalesce. No surprises, no daylight. Briefly, what do they mean? No surprises. If the United States is going to give a major position, a major speech that's going to lay out American policy on issues related to the Middle East and related to Israel's security, they're going to give us an advanced draft of that and give us a chance to look at it and give our comments. No surprises. Secondly, no daylight. We're going to have differences. We're going to have differences over settlements. We're going to have differences over Jerusalem. We're going to have differences over a lot of things. But the idea is that we have these differences behind closed doors and not out in the public, where our enemies will internalize that there's distance between us and they will insinuate themselves between us, and it'll be perceived as weakness and vulnerability. These were the two principles. I can't say that they were honored completely. We surprised one another. There was daylight on various issues. But as a matter of policy, these were the twin pillars of our historic alliance. And starting in 2009, the new Obama administration decided as a matter of policy that it was not going to preserve these two pillars. It was a matter of policy. The president said openly, he said, I'm going to put daylight between Israel and the United States on the peace process. Turns out it was also on other issues like the Iranian. And on the issue of surprises, it wasn't even a matter of debate. In June 2009, the president went to Cairo and gave a speech, which is the foundational document of the Obama administration's positions on the Middle East, a very long speech. It's twice as long as the first inaugural address, the Cairo speech. And it touched on many issues that were vital to Israel's security, not just the peace process, on America's relationship with what Obama called the Muslim world, particularly the outreach to Iran and Iran's right to nuclear energy. Amazing, far-reaching ramifications for Israel. We had no warning about the speech. We never got to see the speech. And that was one of many such speeches. So these were two pillars that were jettisoned during this period. And toward the end of the book, and actually throughout the entire book, I make the case that these two pillars have to be restored. We have to revisit them. It's not only in the interest of the United States and Israel to restore these pillars, but given the immense chaos in the Middle East, for the last semblance of stability in the Middle East, it's important for that as well. And I also believe for the well-being of the world, the U.S.-Israel alliance is good for the planet. It's good for the planet because everybody's looking at us. Whether you're a jihadist or a Japanese, everybody is looking at the way the United States treats its Israeli ally as a litmus of their ability to rely on the United States. And I saw it happen. Everybody watches us. Therefore, we should restore it. Whether it's possible to do now and whatever the year and a half remaining of this presidency, All I can say is I hope so. The book is an ardent and, in some cases, impassioned call to restore this relationship, to bring it back from the brink where I think we've reached. And there's a reason, I'll go into greater detail, why I made it now in mid-June.
One of the most puzzling aspects of the U.S.-Israel relationship is there are all these problems, such as you just explained, but everybody agrees that security, arms, and related to military affairs, is better than ever. How does this, what's the logic behind it?
Because it's true. Better than ever. The situation has changed. Security relationships are excellent. It also depends how you define security relationships. If you exclude the fact that the United States negotiated for 7 months with the Iranians without telling us, and that has a certain impact on our security, you can't say security relationships are better than ever. But the cooperation on weapons development, military aid, which is close to $4 billion a year, 75% of it's spent here, but it's $4 billion a year. It's quite large. Joint maneuvers, ports of call, intelligence sharing are indeed superb right now. But as I point out at one stage in the book, in a very touchy part of the book, the Obama administration made a distinction between diplomatic daylight and the absence of security daylight, and made a calculation that the closer our relations would be on the security field, the greater maneuverability or leeway the administration would have to put daylight in the diplomatic field. And it was a very interesting, I would say, intellectual exercise. But the big problem was, in the Middle East, it doesn't work. Middle Easterners simply do not distinguish between diplomatic daylight and security daylight. It ain't going to work there. And in the Middle East, daylight is daylight. And daylight in our area of the world where the sun is very strong can be blinding and searing. And what most Middle Easterners saw over the course of the last five-plus years was the United States and Israel drifting quite far apart in spite of the increased security cooperation.
You mentioned that you were unaware of U.S.-Iranian discussions, and yet the president has said that he has consistently, or his administration has consistently, shared information with Israel. Is that true?
We had a long-standing and intimate dialogue with the United States on the Iranian nuclear program, and I was privileged to take part in those talks. And they were very candid, frank. We looked at the same data. We often derived the same conclusions. But on the content of that secret tract, and you know where that tract took place, in the Persian Gulf, we were unaware.
You quote the former White House Chief of Staff, Rahm Emanuel, waking up early one morning and yelling at you, "I don't like this effing excrement." On another occasion, the Deputy Secretary of State, the number two man in the State Department, Tom Nides, screamed at you, "You don't want that effing UN to collapse because of your effing conflict with the Palestinians."
If we were in Israel, we'd have no problem actually reading this word. You understand? You're so American. And just say, ugh. Get
so
over it.
So my question is, is this the state of diplomacy? I mean,
yes.
I assume diplomacy has a certain
elegance
to it.
It is funny. And one of the reasons I actually included these conversations. And I should tell you, this book went through 7 security vettings in the state of Israel. The military censor, 2 departments within the defense ministry, the Mossad. Believe me, it's amazing there's actually a book there. They were very good. They were excellent. I actually thanked them in the acknowledgments because it was such an interesting process to go through. I was never a diarist. I've never written any book in the first person. Making that transformation was profound for me, not at all easy. But when I entered this job, Sally, my wife, gave me a little diary and said, "Hey, you may want to jot down a few things." And I said, "Nah, I don't believe in diaries." And then one night, actually very close to that, Rahm Emanuel calls me at 2 o'clock in the morning and says, "Can I say this is Philadelphia? What happens if I say this?" He says, "I don't like this fucking shit." And I'm like, 2 o'clock in the morning. And I said, "Rahm, I don't like this fucking shit either." And then it begins from there. Okay. So I write this in my diary. And the diary is not a classified diary. You're not going to find secrets in there. But it does provide a lot of color to the book and depth to the book. And Tom Nides, poor Tom Nides, Tom Nides was the deputy Secretary of State, and that line, you know, you don't want to fucking defund the UNESCO because they fucking teach the fucking Holocaust. That gets quoted by a lot of people of evidence of sort of some animus on the part of Tom Nides towards the State of Israel. It's just the opposite. Tom Nides is a great friend of myself and of the State of Israel, I want you to know. Nice Jewish boy. But I pointed out in that particular section about the fact that Israelis don't curse. And if you know this, we don't have, the Bible has no curse words in it. We don't have, so what are the curse words we have? We have Russian curse words and Arabic curse words. We don't even know what the hell they mean. Most of them, we don't use them. But in Washington, that's the way people talk in Washington. That is just the way people talk. One story I didn't include in the book, from a high-ranking member of the administration, a very sweet young man from my perspective, says to me the following line, something like this: "We're getting out of fucking Iraq because we fucking had it with the fucking Iraqis. And we're coming fucking home." And then he looks at me and says, "Why am I talking like this?"
That's my next question.
It's so true.
Did you get?
But that's just the way people talk in Washington. It's the way they talk in Hollywood. It's like it's a fault word.
But did you get special treatment because you're American? Had you been from another country and not a Native American speaker, would you have been treated the same way?
No, but it was also the flip side of the special relationship. And it was also part of my special relationship with people like Rahm Emanuel, who I had known for a long time before I got into office. And Rahm didn't. We had serious policy disagreements. Rahm's father had fought in the Irgun in the War of Independence, hence the name Rahm, Thunder. And you know, the Obama tells a story that I quote in the book that Rahm had a deli accident when he was 16 and sliced off the top part of this finger. And according to Obama, when he lost the top part of that finger, he lost half of his vocabulary. But I used to get that finger all the time. Sally does this. Boom, 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 boom. Got the finger. But when Rahm left the White House and went off to be the mayor of Chicago, I viewed it as a loss for me. Because it was somebody I could call in the middle of the night. And yes, I was going to get that language. And even though we had serious policy disagreements sometimes, I knew he cared passionately about Israel. He was a proud Jew, proud of his father. And that created a link that couldn't be broke by policy difference. So his departure was a loss for me, and I talk about that in the book. Same thing is true with Dennis Ross, who doesn't talk like that. But Dennis really doesn't, of course. But Dennis was that rare Washington Middle East expert who wasn't, as we say in Washington speak, stovepiped. Which means, you know, you get somebody who's an expert in Lebanon between 1976 and 1977. That's what they know. Everything that happened on every day between 1976 and a certain, the northern eastern part of Lebanon. That's called stovepiping. Dennis was the only person I knew in Washington who saw the entire region and then saw it historically, vertically and horizontally, and had a historic memory himself. He'd been involved in peacemaking for 30 years. And when he left, it was a huge loss, huge loss. I talk about this break of 2000, between two, really after 2 years in Washington, everyone basically burns out and goes home. The longevity of a Washington policymaking light bulb is 2 years, and people burn out and go home. So this was a big loss. I'm sorry, that was a longer answer than no.
I'd like to try out two theories on you, two favorite theories of mine. First is noting that the government of Israel tends to give away too much when relations are really warm between the U.S., between Jerusalem and Washington. I believe that low-level tensions between the two countries, between the two governments, are actually good.
See, here I beg to disagree. I think that historically, Israelis make concessions when we feel secure. So there's a conversation I quote in the book where Obama tells a group of American Jewish leaders, first meeting with American Jewish leaders, and I'm going to put daylight between Israel and the United States, because when Israel sees that there's no daylight, it sits on the side and doesn't do anything. So it was an interesting observation, because empirically it was wrong. During the Bush years, there was no daylight. And in 2005, Israel yanked up 21 settlements from Gaza. In 2008, Israel made a full offer of Palestinian statehood to Mahmoud Abbas in all of Gaza, most of the West Bank, and half of Jerusalem. That's when Israelis felt secure. It's when Israelis feel insecure. They don't In 2002, at the height of the Second Intifada, the support for two-state solution was exactly zero. By the time I came on board in 2009, the Intifada was behind us. Support for the two-state solution was 70% of Israelis. So when we feel secure, we give more concessions. The person who understood this best was Richard Nixon. Strange enough. You give them support, they'll make concessions.
But I made that point.
Oh, that was your point?
That was my point.
Okay.
I'm
You're
saying
right.
When U.S.-Israel relations are flourishing, the Israelis hand over.
Yes.
For example, the Philadelphia corridor in 2007, a mistake. Therefore, I don't mind seeing...
Oh, you want a little low-level
exactly.
tension, so we don't give in.
Right.
Well, I can't argue with that, but my responsibility as ambassador was to try to get us on the same page. And since they were coming to us and say, listen, we demand settlement freeze, we demand freeze in Jerusalem, we demand you give us a map for the Palestinians, they're asking us to do a lot of very difficult things. Every time we'd given the Palestinians a map, they put it in their pocket, walked away, came back 2 years later and said, okay, let's start negotiating from the last time you gave us a map. So we didn't want to give them a map, but the administration wanted us to give them a map. So I would say to the administration all the time, rather than threatening us, try love. It was always my line, try love, because Israelis make concession when we feel secure. Isn't that true of human nature? It's not just Israelis, right?
So I
I've been getting away with that for years.
I think you're kind of. I think you're kind of agreeing with me. The second theory I have is that there used to be a consensus, say back in the 80s, between Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals on Israel, and it's falling apart, with conservatives ever more friendly to Israel and liberals ever cooler to Israel. It sounds like, from the anecdotes you tell in your book, that you agree with this, right?
From the anecdotes I told in the group, I talk about the challenges we faced from certain segments of the American electorate, certain segments of the American population. One of the recurring themes is transformations. We lived in Israel. I've lived in Israel now for close to 40 years. I've come back. I've taught at various universities. But for the first time in 2008, I came back for a year to America. And I had a Rip Van Winkle. I had a whimsical experience. It's like I'd woken up after 25 years and didn't recognize my own village. America had transformed, had changed demographically. America was no longer a white majority population. America, there were more single parent families in America than two parent families. When I grew up, you had one Jewish judge on the Supreme Court, and the rest were basically WASPs. Now you didn't have any WASPs on the Supreme Court. You had three Jews, and the rest were Catholics. America's changing all different ways. The populations, whether African American or Hispanic, the populations that were growing and having greater political influence, especially the Hispanics, and they weren't traditionally attached to Israel, didn't have strong ties with Israel. So very different America. We had a problem because many Israeli leaders, including our prime minister and defense minister, had been educated in America in the 70s or in the 80s. They remembered a different America. So I had to come back to them and say, guys, the America you remembered, it ain't there anymore. And I saw Obama's election in 2008 as a transformative moment, not as a cause, but as a symptom. And again, as I say in the book, I'm not a prophet, but I began to tell Israeli leaders back in 2009 that we have a two-term president. We have to plan for a two-term president because these changes are permanent. And I think that the election of 2012 was much more significant. It showed that they were permanent. And that Israel would have to adjust to the degree that it could, that accorded with our basic security interests, we'd have to adjust to it, or at least recognize that the changes had occurred. So I even forget what your original question was. America.
Liberals, conservatives.
Hmm?
Liberals, conservatives.
Liberals, conservatives. So liberal conservatives, yes, Israel has a paramount strategic interest in preserving support for Israel as a bipartisan issue, and we should never become the monopoly of one party or even part of a party or another.
But it became
increasingly challenging. It just did. For all sorts of reasons we don't have time to discuss here, some of them illusory, some of the products of impression, some of the fact that Israel had undergone 15 years of terror and had moved significantly to the right. America was moving to the left. America was becoming more traditional. Israel's becoming more traditional. America less traditional. Moving. Just drift. And it was a reality with which I had to grapple and try my best to bridge. Did I succeed entirely? Obviously not. Can we give it up? We cannot. And we have to keep on reaching out. Last point. American opinion on Israel is a little like what physicists say about the universe. It's expanding and contracting at the same time. If you look at all the polls, support for Israel in this country keeps on going up. Even last summer, at the height of this war, with these terrible images coming out of Gaza, support for Israel in this country went up. At the height, when I left, it was something like 74% of Americans defined themselves to one degree or another as pro-Israel. Crazy. We're behind Sweden and Canada, countries in the world. Amazing. Considering all the bad press we get. On the other hand, if you break it down demographically, if you break it down by ethnic group, if you break it by age group, if you break it by who votes for which party, the picture's a lot less sanguine.
Turning to the responses to your book, American officials have been incensed by Ally, your book. Your former counterpart, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Daniel Shapiro, said, quote, "I can say as ambassador that sometimes ambassadors have a very limited view of the conversations between the leaders, and Oren's description does not reflect the truth of what happened," unquote. Secretary of State John Kerry, his spokesman, said that the book is absolutely inaccurate and false. Now, Shapiro is saying he doesn't know anything, and therefore you don't know anything.
Kerry is a strange remark for an ambassador to say about another ambassador. We were listening to it in live radio, and I kind of chuckled.
But they're not actually refuting you. They're just simply saying it's all nonsense.
I've been called a muddy, grubbing politician.
Yep.
I've been called delusional. I've been called a couple of choice words in the last week and a half. But what's interesting for me is, with all the ad hominem stuff, is that nobody's taking on the book substantively. You got 400 pages of a book here that tells a story. And virtually no one's coming up and telling the story's wrong. No one's actually taking it on the facts. All right, maybe they didn't negotiate for 7 months without telling us. Maybe last summer, a decision by the administration to cancel flights to Ben Gurion Airport and close down our airport didn't happen. Maybe I just imagined it. There are irrefutable facts in this book, and the book, alas, is replete with them. Not all of them bad. I want you to know that the impression here, and I think part of the reaction I've received from people in government, notice there's all people in government, not people out of government, has been an oversensitivity to the issue I'm trying to raise. And here I come to why I brought the book out now. Why now? Who needs to do this? You know, those of you in the book publishing world know that June is the last time you want to bring out a nonfiction book. June is already summer reading, right? June is when you bring out Jaws. I told Random House we should change the name of the book. We should call it Jews. People will read it on the beach. They won't go in the water. I know you guys are all my age because you get that joke. That's depressing. You bring out a book in October, November. You get the Christmas Hanukkah book thing. You know, this is the last thing you do. I'm in Knesset. I can't even promote the book the way I was supposed to. I used to go on a 2-month book tour. You want to go bring it out in the Jewish Book Month, which is November. It's the absolute wrong time to bring out this book. And for me personally, I brought it out now because in the next week or so, there is liable to be an agreement signed between the United States, other permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany, and the Islamic Republic of Iran, which the state of Israel, not my party, not the prime minister, but the state of Israel views as a terrible deal that deeply endangers us. And there was no way I could be derelict in my duty but to tell this story right now. I'm telling you straight out. And yes, sometimes you get the stuff and be out. But a reporter asked me tonight, you know, how are you holding up all, you know, under all this this vindictiveness, all this name-calling. And I said, trust me, the summer of in Beirut in 1982 was tougher. It just was. But, you know, it's not easy. I don't care. I don't care. The book had to come out now, and it had to trigger the type of conversation we're having precisely tonight. Because otherwise, what do we expect? Are we supposed to go silently? What do they expect from us, to go silently into that night of the signing of this agreement? We can't do that. As the Jewish people, we can't do that.
But it sounds like Jewish American leaders want to go silently. Let me give another two choice quotes. Former Congressman Mel Levine described himself as astounded by the distortions and falsehoods an ally, and Abraham Foxman of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, condemned your book as insensitive and unjustified, and he called on you to retract...
No, not the book, an article I wrote, but okay, doesn't matter.
Fair enough. All right. And called on you to retract statements that veer into the realm of conspiracy theories. It doesn't look like they're getting the message.
Well, Mel Levine was a congressman, in the 80s? I don't necessarily call him a Jewish leader. Abe Foxman, different category. Again, it's all innuendo and all ad hominem. Someone tell me something in the book is wrong. I'm waiting for that discussion. Honestly, I'm perfectly prepared for it. Show me something that's wrong. I got the editor of the op-ed page of the New York Times saying that Shimon Peres never submitted an op-ed. That was a response to Mahmoud Abbas. I've got the op-ed. Okay, I'm willing. And if I made a mistake, by the way, I got this terrible news for you all. Historians make mistakes once in a while in their history. We do. Maybe get a time wrong, a date wrong. We can even be wrong in our interpretations. But I'm willing to have the dialogue. I don't see it happening anywhere. And so this attempt to delegitimize what's in the book by delegitimizing me, I get it. And I think I can take it. And I'm waiting on the stage.
Good for you.
Go for it.
I admire your strength. Let me turn to the last of the three topics. The president. What do you better think explains his approach to the Middle East, the world, a grand strategy, or improvising responses as things happened?
I think the president, as I think all presidents, came into the White House with a worldview. It was a worldview that was very challenging for the state of Israel. Not just for the state of Israel, but very challenging for us. It was my job. Because the worldview included a collegial approach to crisis management and world affairs. Right? We're not the policemen anymore. This notion of American exceptionalism, American leadership, that was not part of the worldview. A certain recoiling from the use of military might. One of the most illuminating remarks I ever heard the president make was in a 2010 nuclear summit where he said, following, and I have these words engraved on my soul here, whether we like it or not, America is the world's leading military power. Think about that for a second. Would John Kennedy have said that? Would Bill Clinton have said that? Never mind George Bush. Some of us wake up in the morning and say a little bracha that the most powerful, the greatest democracy in the world just happens to be the greatest military power. It's a great thing. But that was very revealing in terms of the president's attitude toward military might. A heavy reliance on international organizations like the UN, which are not always so friendly to the state of Israel. And then the issues, the positions of the worldview that are related directly to the Middle East. Outreach to the Muslim world, which I thought was perfectly fine. America gets better relations with Muslims. It's great, as long as it's not at our expense. It's in our interest. But more specifically, unprecedented support for the Palestinian cause and reconciliation with Iran, which was very problematic for us. So this is a worldview. Now, that worldview has collided with the world. And the result has been something that looks like a patchwork, which is intervention against Gaddafi, but not intervention against Assad. Condemning, sort of implicitly cooperating with Shiite forces around back Syria against ISIS in Iraq, but kind of resisting what Saudi's doing in Yemen against ISIS, and definitely resisting what Egypt was doing against ISIS in Libya. I can go on. It's sort of a patchwork, and what happens when a worldview can't accord with the world, with reality. And there's been a struggle to keep up. Now, in the book, I actually say at times I could empathize with this because the Arab Spring, as it evolved in the winter of 2011, was happening so fast in so many different places in so many different ways. It was very difficult to develop a one-size-fits-all policy. It was just difficult. But what is interesting for me, and I will conclude with this, at the end of what? Now, 5.5 years, almost 6 years of turmoil, of unprecedented turmoil and violence and disappointment in the Middle East, so much of that worldview has remained impermeable to change. Mm-hmm. Remains exactly the same. And that's interesting.
My final question, where I disagree with you.
Please.
You argue that Obama's gut, or Kishke, causes...
I hope that catches on.
...of creating a Palestinian state,
yes,
reconciling with Islam, and preventing nuclear proliferation, reflects in some fashion his Muslim background. Now, I have done a lot of work on...
Only in part.
Only in part.
I go into long detail about where that comes from.
Affected by it. I have done a lot of work on Obama's early life, and I have concluded that there is no doubt that he was born and raised a Muslim. But I also conclude that he has converted to Christianity and that there is no difference between him and other liberal Democrats, progressive Democrats, who share his views. I do not see any places where his Muslim background affects his current policies. I think any American politician of the same outlook would have the same policies.
Okay, so I'm going to disagree
to give an illustration or two where this Muslim dimension has had an impact.
So a part of the book, I talk about coming into the embassy in 2009, and like an historian, I wasn't a diplomat by training. I take my historian skills and I apply them to diplomacy by giving myself a course, a crash course that I call Obama 101. I got to figure out who I'm dealing with. And, you know, he gave some very powerful speeches in during the course of the election, but we had to know who this person was. It wasn't as if he had been on in American politics for a long time, had been on the world stage for a long time. Figure out who he was. So I went through all of his speeches, all of his interviews, and particularly the things that he wrote about himself and said about himself were very important for me. And I reached some conclusions. The goal was never to be surprised, to be able to get a sense of where he was going. And what did I conclude? I concluded, yes, I don't think he was born a Muslim. I think he was raised Christian. He thinks he considers himself Christian. I've heard him speak passionately about his Christianity. We've heard him speak passionately about his Christianity, surprisingly, because he doesn't speak about it publicly that much. But that he had a Muslim father, Muslim stepper, had spent time. He himself in the Cairo speech says the following line: I have known Islam on three continents before I have now encountered it in the land where it was revealed. Okay, quote unquote. He says this. By the way, it's very good dealing with the character of the president because he's very vocal and tells you a lot. I don't have to interpret very much because it's mostly quotes. And yes, in the early part of his first term, actually throughout the whole first term, and people have very short memories, he used to mention his Muslim family connections in just about every public opinion. He mentions it in the first inaugural address. Who remembers that? His first TV appearance was on Al Arabiya television and talked about his Muslim family. His first overseas visits are to Ankara and to Cairo and talks about his Muslim family. So it's not me making this up. He says it. It's there. He talks about it quite openly and what it means to him. And I think that, yes, that helped inform his outreach. And he portrayed himself as a human bridge. I'm a bridge between America and what he called the Muslim world, which is even quite a loaded term, as you know. It's ummah. It's an Islamic concept, the Muslim world. So, yes, but Obama, that's only a small part of Obama 101. I think the whole thing is maybe a paragraph, and it's a section that goes on for several pages. What I do discuss is the intellectual and academic background that I believe informed Obama's worldview. And having spent time on American campuses, I was very personally acquainted with that academic worldview. I go into the writings of Edward Said. I go into the history of American campuses since the revolutions of the 1960s and what had occurred in various campuses, particularly urban campuses where he studied or taught. It was Columbia, Harvard, and Chicago. And I had experiences in all of these campuses, by the way. So they were very, very familiar to me. And I quote at length from a document published in 2008 that was a monograph that was authored by several academics, and the Obama administration had a high percentage of academics, probably the highest since the Kennedy administration, who would soon occupy senior positions in the Obama administration, talking about an American foreign policy for the 21st century. And it was amazing. In there, heavy reliance on the UN and other international bodies. No more American leadership in the world. We do things collegially. Right? The only thing America leads is the effort for Israeli-Palestinian peace. It's the only thing it leads. reticence for military power, outreach to the Muslim world. There's a great line in there. We have to talk about the great achievements of Islam. Okay, it's a line in there. So this president of the United States came out of a milieu, an academic milieu, which was familiar, and it was documented. And if you used your historical skills, you could get to it. And it made me sometimes seem very prophetic, and I'm sorry if I seem like that in my book. I have to apologize for being prophetic. But it wasn't prophecy. It was just doing your homework, which is what I call it, doing my homework.
Very good.
All right.
I think you agree with me, but let's move on to the audience. The Platonic ideal of a question is brief and 10, 15, 20 seconds, and it ends with a question mark. Please try to attain this. No preambles, no commentaries, no double-barreled questions. I'll be a tough moderator so we can get things moving. First question, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Ambassador Oren, for your words. You mentioned about the timing of the book and the Iran deal coming up less than a week now. And yet you knew the things that are in your book much earlier than before the book came out. Why even wait? I realize you probably don't want to preempt your own book, but why wait, given the critical nature of the revelations in your book and what you were exposed to? Why not come out with at least some of the warnings much earlier than you did?
I have most of it, albeit in the Israeli press. And I've been talking, from the moment I returned to Israel, I've been talking about the looming Iranian bad deal threat and how Americans have to rally. Americans have to rally against, especially American Jews. I did it during my term in Washington, by the way. I never held back. I never said that this was a good deal. But most the interim agreement was reached in November 2013, and that was a month after I had already returned to Israel. So I already was not in that position. But the minute it came out, I was unequivocal in saying what we had to do. I think now, on a deeper level, that the issue of trust has arisen. You know, the mantra from Washington has been, trust us, trust me, I've got your back, I'm not bluffing, all of those. Does that sound familiar to you? So I want to be able to document how the trust broke down, because the trust did break down, and also delve into the question of bluffing. About 2 weeks ago, the president gave an interview on Israeli television. And Israeli viewers were surprised to hear him say there really is no military option. This is after 6 years where he's told us that all options are on the table and he's not bluffing. So Israelis heard this and were shocked. Not just myself. I was maybe less shocked, but Israelis were shocked. I think that has to be documented. It's important to understand how we got to where we are. But it's also important at the end of the book to talk about how we pull back from the brink. I'm not going to leave my reader just hanging there, and I'm not going to leave my state and people hanging there. I'm not even going to leave America hanging there. If I can, I want you to come back from the brink.
Given the history of the world living with atomic weapons in Pakistan and North Korea, and given the history of Iran as a nation of thousands of years of history, why isn't it in the best interest of the United States and the world to try to bring Iran back into the world citizenship, much the same way Nixon did with China?
Hallelujah. It's a great idea. Just don't do it with a nuclear deal. Don't do it with a nuclear deal that's going to leave them with the ability, according to an op-ed that appeared, I think, yesterday in the New York Times by Alan Cooperman, one of the nation's experts in nuclear proliferation. It's going to leave them with a breakout town of something in the order of a month, which is just, you must understand that the United States is a big country. It's far away from the Middle East. You have the world's largest military capabilities. You're not threatened with national annihilation by the Iranians. Israel's a tiny country. We're in Iran's backyard. We are threatened with genocide by the regime. They're open about it. And we have a very respectable army, but we don't have B-2 bombers. We don't have aircraft carriers. Our margin for error on Iran is exactly zero. And it's not about legacy. It's not about policy. It's about our kids' and grandchildren's lives. Put that simply, we can't afford to fool around. So if you want to bring Iran back into the community of nations, do so. but don't think you're going to be doing it by giving them a one-month breakout capacity. Don't think you're going to do so by lifting sanctions and giving them $50 billion that they are not going to spend on better education and roads. There's not. They're going to use it to kill Jews. And they're going to use it to undermine pro-Western governments throughout the Middle East. And they're going to use it to fund international terror because Iran is the world's largest state sponsor of terror. Largest state sponsor. They're operating in this hemisphere. Make no mistake about it. So you want to bring them in? Here's one way you do. You want us to lift sanctions? Start reforming the way you behave. Stop trying to undermine our allies. Stop supporting terror. And stop threatening to kill 8 million Israelis. That's a very good response.
Well, very well said. Thank you. Next.
Some people, including Carolyn Glick, have said that considered bringing the PLO back from Libya as being a serious mistake.
Tunisia. Yeah.
What's your view?
In retrospect, it's like Chou En Lai once. Henry Kissinger once asked Chou En Lai whether he thought the French Revolution was successful. And Chou said it's too early. Right? I think that that's sort of, to use a very non-Middle Eastern cliche, it's sort of Monday morning quarterbacking. We don't know. We don't know what would have transpired in Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, had we not brought the PLO back. Maybe we'd have Hamas now and not the PLO. Maybe we'd have ISIS. ISIS is penetrating these areas now. I don't know. I think there were fatal flaws in the Oslo process. I write about them in the book. I worked for the Rabin government in the early 90s, and I saw the flaws back then. The fundamental flaw from my perspective in the Oslo process was the fact that we, the State of Israel, recognized that there was a Palestinian people endowed with an inalienable right to self-determination in what the Palestinians regarded as their homeland. That was fine. The problem is it was never reciprocated. They never recognized the existence of a Jewish people with the same inalienable historic right to a state in our homeland. And that asymmetry was fatal.
To put it a little differently, they never recognized it in Arabic. They did it in English.
No, they never recognized Israel. There was an exchange of letters between Rabin and Arafat. We recognized the Palestinian people. They recognized Israel. So you take Israel and you stick 5 million Palestinian refugees and their descendants back in Israel. It's still Israel, but it's a Palestinian state. And Israel has no permanence. There's no recognition of the fact that there actually is. This was a conversation I would often have with American audiences on campuses, but particularly American Jewish audiences that were progressive. Because we were making the demand of the Palestinians that they recognize us as the Palestinian state. Not a precondition, but somewhere along the line, we said, listen, the only way to end the conflict is for you to recognize Israel as the Jewish state. So opponents of the policy would stand up and say, you're being obstructionist. You're just creating another demand that the Palestinians can't make. And I always use the metaphor of the house. Two families own the same house. Lay claim to the same house. And the only way to solve the problem is to divide the house. But one family recognizes the second family's right to half the house, but the other family denies the first family's right to even half the house. And what goes on in that house, if you don't have mutual recognition, you have the two families go on warring. It was that simple. And so I thought that mutual and simultaneous recognition of the fact that we're both peoples and both have a right to self-determination in what we regard as our homeland was the only way to proceed. It's the only way to actually have a durable peace. I think it was probably asking far too much of the Palestinians. I don't think they're capable of doing that. It goes to the core of their identity, but it was the basis for peace.
This won't take long. Question, comment, thought, real quick. Thought. I would really wish we could have walked past a metal detector before we walked in here. I'm scared about security. You ain't going to fix that for the future.
Okay.
Comment. Regarding the issue of the Islamism component of the Obama family, the most recent example of what I consider to be that core point, I agree with you, Michael, was when Michelle was talking about how she agreed with all those children in London who were Muslims, who, in terms of her background, about 2-3 days ago. Check it out. Here's the question. I read the book Index. I did not see any reference to Stuxnet. I didn't see any reference to the Azerbaijan. I read the articles you wrote, the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, and Foreign Policy.
Question.
Okay, here it is. You do not deal with what I consider to be the core question, and that is Obama an anti-Semite?
I do deal with that question.
Why not?
I say no.
And tell us why not.
I say it repeatedly in this book. He is not just not an anti-Semite, he's not anti-Israel. I say it again and again. Yes, it's true, he's pro a certain type of Israel and a certain image of Israel. Some of that image, I say in the book, was mythic, pre-67. He seems to think we were more liberal and democratic back then. We were much less liberal and democratic back then. In a synagogue about 2 weeks ago in Washington, he talked about that Moshe Dayan was the hero and the embodiment of values, which would come to a surprise of a lot of people who have studied Moshe Dayan. But anti-Israel, absolutely not. And I give examples, sometimes when Israel faced very difficult circumstances, when Obama was there for us. And he was certainly there for me. And I gave there's a very moving passage in the book that talks about Obama's help to us during the Carmel fire. And I urge you to read it to show that this relationship is very nuanced. It's not black and white. It's not that this guy hates us and this guy is anti-Israel. Life isn't like that, and diplomacy isn't like that. But there has been damage, and there has been deterioration. You cannot gainsay that. And this is a desperate plea, if you will, and I have no problem using that word. It's a desperate plea to stop. It comes at the end of the word, actually. At the end of the book, I say, stop, enough. Let's have a discussion. This is where we have to restore the relationship. I did this with a deep sense of responsibility. And I say again, in respect to some of the other things you mentioned, this book went through 7 vettings. Please, can I get this? This she's been very... Now you don't have the question anymore. I answered it. What?
Exactly. Right. Notwithstanding what we talked about, Obama's relationship with Islam. Westerners do not understand the Arab mentality. I'm not just talking about...
Is there such a thing as an Arab mentality? Lots of Arabs out there with different mentalities.
Well, I understand that. It's a generalization. Mm-hmm. How do you feel living in the bad neighborhood that you do?
I grew up in a very,
very
tough neighborhood. I write about that, too. I grew up in a Sicilian neighborhood. I was the only Jewish kid in my block.
Yeah. How do you feel about people from the outside judging your actions when there's aggression from the other side?
It's tough.
Now, there's a flotilla on its way. How do you handle people telling you how to handle it to defend your own self?
Yesterday, I was on Morning Joe. And Joe Scarborough said, I just dated myself. He was in the 70s. Joe Scarborough says to me, you guys surprised us sometimes. During last summer, you bombed the hell out of all these Palestinian neighborhoods. Watch it. And I said, let's leave that apart. We were facing an enemy that fired 4,500 rockets at us from behind a civilian population, densely populated civilian population. You don't want to have to deal with the moral dilemmas that we dealt with. And I say unequivocally that Israel dealt with them in a way that no other army on earth would ever deal with. But you can't accuse Joe Scarborough of being ill-disposed toward Israel. He's not. But here is a person who likes us, but has this criticism of us as if we willfully went in and bombed Palestinian neighborhoods last summer. And yes, that is painful and frustrating. You want to tear what remains of your hair up. It's very difficult. Right now, just before I came to the library tonight, I got interviewed by an Israeli paper. And journalists, it's interesting, you probably encounter this, they don't actually read the source, they read what other journalists write. So I was at the Y the other night, and I was talking about Israel's relationship with American Jewry. I was talking parts of the book of that to deal in an impassioned way with the difficulties we face in trying to understand one another. And I said that one of the greatest challenges I faced was that Israelis, I talked about this at dinner, some of you were at dinner tonight, Israelis don't understand the American Jewish march for civil rights. If you say Selma to an Israeli, he doesn't know. You know, he thinks it's somebody's aunt in Long Island. Honestly. they don't know that you don't have to say to an American Jew what Selma is. Right? It means something. It's loaded with historical meaning. It evokes passions. But going to an Israeli, to an American Jew and saying, what is it to expect American Jews to understand what it was like to withdraw from Lebanon in 2000 and get struck with thousands of rockets, to withdraw from Gaza in 2005, get struck with thousands of rockets, to make a peace agreement with the PLO in 1993 and lose 1,000 Israelis to suicide bombers, to get American Jews to say, we want a two-state solution. But wait a minute, look what happened. It's very hard for them to understand our reality. So the headline in the Israeli paper was, Oren: American Jews don't understand Israel. So I got asked by an Israeli journalist, how could you condemn American Jewry like that? The Forward ran a headline today, Oren doesn't get American Jews. It's all based on what this journalist said, what I said at the Y. Missed that whole conversation, by the way. It was a very detailed and passionate conversation. So that is frustrating, but sometimes we contribute to our own, we magnify our own difficulties by falsifying things that ex-ambassadors say.
Hillary Clinton may be the next president of the United States. Should that be the case, Ambassador? Does your gut react to that with indifference, enthusiasm, or fear?
Neither. I'm not going to get dragged into an internal American political debate. I'm not even American anymore, even though I sound like this. Book opens with how I have to give up my American citizenship. Very painful also. Listen, I know several of the Republican candidates. I had the great honor of hosting Lindsey Graham for lunch a couple of weeks ago in the Knesset. He's terrific. And I worked extensively with Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. She's formidable. She's buff. She is... physically robust. I don't know how she ever did these things.
Let me re-ask that question at dinner in a way that you as a foreigner might be able to answer.
Go ahead.
You don't look like a foreigner.
I'm working on
sound
it.
Like a foreigner.
Yeah.
You are a foreigner. Do you think there'll be more continuity or change from the Obama years?
Fair question. That's a fair question. Your fair question is fair, too. Okay, so it's not about trepidation and fear. It's about how you deal with the reality. She is a Democrat. Okay. Democratic Party is in a certain position, has certain positions. It has a liberal base. And if she is elected president, then we will have to, as I did in 2009 in interacting with the Obama administration, we're going to have to figure out how we can adapt. Sometimes we can't adapt. When I speak to Israeli audiences, I always say our relationship with the United States should always be, our conversation should always start off like this. Thank you, thank you, thank you. But every once in a while we have to say thank you, but. This is a thank you about Iran. Thank you, but moment. Big but. And to the degree that I understand her position on Palestinian issues, it's gonna challenge us in a way that maybe somebody else wouldn't. I am a member of a centrist party. We're in the coalition. I designed the diplomatic platform for our party. You want to look it up. It was in the Wall Street Journal about 3 months ago. It was called The Two-State Situation. And I believe that if Israel... would adapt that position, then we could get along very well with another President Clinton. We'd certainly get along well with the other presidents as well. But I also think it would also help us. It would protect us to a large extent from some of the threats of boycotts and sanctions that are coming out of Europe.
So I think I'm hearing more continuity than change.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.